It was a busy week last week in Westminster, so you may have forgotten that there was a big announcement on railways, alongside the announcement that the first part of HS2 would go ahead. The government promised £500 million to reverse some of the beaching cuts. Well, they were instituted in the mid-60s and saw 5,000 miles of railway chopped from the map. I will discuss what could be done to reinstate them, particularly in Scotland, in a few minutes. But first, here's Dr. Beeching himself, talking on this very day, back in 1965, about the aspirations of his latest plan.
The lines that are not selected for intensive use as trunk routes will, in most cases, still have a continuing purpose to serve. And we shall modify them as necessary to make them serve that purpose in the best possible way.
If this survey is implemented, how much do you expect to save in a year?
This is a question to which I can only give a very broad answer, a general indication, because we haven't yet planned these changes in detail, and we shall only make the assessments of financial savings when we do that. But for the purpose of giving a broad indication, £50 to £100 million a year.
Well, Christian Wolmar is a rail expert and analyst who's written several books on the past, present and future of Britain's railways. He says Beeching himself gets a pretty rough deal from history writers.
It's a bit unfair to call them the Beeching cuts, because Richard Beeching was the chairman of British Rail. Now, he was appointed by a Tory minister, Ernest Marples, to make a recommendation around what lines should be cut and what lines should survive. But ultimately, it was the politicians who did this, and there were politicians of both sides. Tory politicians started this, but the Labour government, which was first elected in 1964 and then got a strong majority in 1966, they actually made many of the cuts. And in a way, some of it was inevitable. There had been cuts to the railway network over the years. You know, about a couple of thousand miles had been cut from the peak total by the time the Beeching cuts started in the early 60s. And that was an inevitable process. If you look at a map, which I produced in my book, Fire and Steam, of the railway network in, say, the northeast of Scotland in the 1960s, just before the cuts, you know, there's a whole bunch of lines connecting kind of relatively small villages in the area. And, you know, that was never going to be sustainable in the age of the motor car. It just, you know, it was, people were just not using those services, and they were inevitably up for the chop. But what Beeching, you know, mistake that was made by the politicians who cut the line after the Beeching report was to chop out kind of major routes between kind of towns that might have been secondary routes, but nevertheless would be a wonderful asset today.
But I suppose part of the problem was that in getting rid of stations and the permanent way itself and all the costs of that, they also got rid of that right of way, which is now very costly to reinstate. That's what we found with things like the Borders Railway.
Yes, I mean, let's first of all start by being sensible. Yeah. You know, the idea that the government can reverse Beeching cuts. He cut kind of, or as a result of his report, 5,000 miles, a couple of thousand stations were cut. Now, over the past 20, 30 years, there's been about 800-900 miles of line reinstated and a couple of hundred stations. So some of those cuts have already been reversed. But the idea that, you know, you're going to be able to bring back railways along even a significant proportion of this is just fanciful. The important thing, though, is to look at a few important routes where really it would help to bring back some smaller towns onto the rail network, or where there might be some new developments since the line was closed and so on. Look at those and bring them back. But you know, we are not going to reverse beaching in any kind of serious way.
Why does it cost so much to reinstate railway lines? Just talking again about the Borders Railway, well, that was £300 million. I mean, that's a huge amount of money for quite a short distance. Is it because standards are higher now than they were in the Victorian times, or is it just the cost of infrastructure?
It's all those things and a few more. It's the fact that, yes, I mean, the railways were built to fairly basic standards, and now we, you know, if you reinstate them, you, to some extent, you gold plate it, which is a mistake. I mean, you put in modern signalling, you put in, you know, the most modern track, you try and keep reasonably straight alignments, so all that is expensive. I think the British way of contracting out things is problematic. I mean, the Britain's railway network is already kind of broken up into all these different companies. So you've got Network Rail, you've got the train operators, you've got the rolling stock manufacturers, and so on. You've got no guiding mind, which in fact might be introduced as a result of the review, the Williams review currently taking place. But you have no kind of fat controller running this, making sure things happen. And we tend to contract out too much and not do enough ourselves. The companies don't do enough themselves to ensure that costs are kept to a minimum. I mean, once you start contracting out a lot of stuff, it tends to be that the contractors always come back to say, oh, sorry, Gov, it's going to cost you more. A bit like when you do up your kitchen, you know, it's the same sort of process. We've lost the expertise for this, of course. Now, if you had a rolling program of bringing back lines into use and you had a system by which this was done in a way kind of strategically with people going on to from one job to another, bit in the way that the railways were built, actually. If you had that, then you might kind of bring costs down. But instead, every project is discrete, separate. There's a whole process. Network Rail has this thing called the GRIP process, which is the governments of railway infrastructure projects. And you have to go through every one of these processes, nine kind of processes. It's all incredibly bureaucratic and difficult.
It's also very expensive, as we've seen with the preliminary work that's been done on HS2, for instance, which is not really that huge a line, you know, the initial part of it, London to Birmingham, where they've just been scoping it out and they've been doing some compulsory purchase orders. That's cost a fortune because you're buying up properties which are going to cost hundreds of thousands of pounds each.
Yes, and that's been an incredibly inefficient process and difficult. I must say, reopening any of the beaching lines wouldn't be quite on that scale. You really just have to bring back into use, hopefully, an alignment that hasn't been built on. Now, that's a big issue, or whether bridges haven't all kind of been brought down. It must be said that around the country where lines have been reopened, you know, stations have been well used. I mean, the Borders Railway is clearly an example of that, where actually, because it was so expensive initially, they brought it back to a lower standard with not very many passing points. And now they find even running a half-hour railway is very difficult. And yet, you know, it's proved so popular, they can't run enough trains on it. So this demonstrates that, you know, there is a huge latent appetite for people to get on the railways once they have the chance of doing so.
But it's difficult, isn't it? Because governments have to shell out for the reinstatement, for the capital cost of these lines. But then they'll also be on the hook for subsidising every journey on it. I mean, that's what happens at the moment, isn't it? Every train journey is subsidised by the taxpayer.
No, by and large. I mean, obviously, some routes are profitable, but most are subsidized. But, you know, one has to view the railways in a wider context. I mean, look what the Borders Railway has already done to that part of the country south of Edinburgh. You know, it's made it possible for people to commute into Edinburgh itself. It's boosted tourism. I understand there's even a couple of factories have kind of been established as a result of that railway line. So, you know, you have to view the railways in a much wider societal context, in a way that, you know, there's lots of country roads that are barely used by half a dozen cars an hour, and yet we never talk about closing them down. And they're seen as kind of vital part of the fabric of the country, and you know, people have to get access to places. Well, the railways have to be viewed in that context. They can't just be viewed as a financial narrow business, which is tempted to do so because they have sort of been semi-privatized, but they are essentially a social function.
And do the same arguments apply to high-speed rail? And where do you think that's going to go? We've had this announcement of HS2 going to Birmingham and possibly up to Manchester and Leeds. There has been talk, particularly in Scotland, that politically the Johnson government might consider starting another high-speed line from Scotland, working its way south, as it were, to meet up. Do you think that's a political statement? That would be a political statement, wouldn't it?
Yes, I must say, I think that is a bit of pie-in-the-sky stuff, as is the idea that you're going to get a bridge between Scotland and Northern Ireland. I think Boris Johnson has always had some fanciful ideas. Remember the Estuary Airport and the Thames, the Garden Bridge. You know, we've been here before. So I think you'll have to wait an awful long time, if not forever, to actually get high-speed lines right up to Scotland, because the traffic just would not merit it. And you have reasonably good lines already that you know, traverse the north of England and south of Scotland, north of Newcastle, north of Carlisle. And I can't see that you're ever going to get a high-speed line going up there.
Christian Wolmer. Dr. Beeching's plans for Britain's railway network didn't survive intact for very long. By the summer of 1966, Labour Transport Secretary Barbara Castle was already looking to revise the plan, which had been instigated by her Conservative predecessors. Here she is explaining a little of what might have to change. And
on the railways, your plan to subsidise uneconomic lines, does this mean the end of the Beeching policy?
It means a modification of the Beeching policy, certainly, because it states the principle that we can't just leave our railways to run down and down in accordance with commercial principles. The country's got to decide it needs a railway system, what size system it needs, then stabilise that system and see that we help to finance it.
Is there any question of reopening lines that have already been closed?
It might be that in certain areas, the new local transportation authorities, which I visualise, would decide that as part of their local transport plan, they wanted to open a certain railway line again. And if they could make a good case for it in the context of the plan and were willing to subsidise it locally, well, then I should not stand in the way.
Well, 50-odd years ago, we're still talking about this. Let's discuss with Bruce Williamson of Rail Future, which is an independent railways think tank and campaign group, and Eugene Clark, who was part of the Leavenmouth Rail campaign, which fought a successful battle to bring back passenger services to that part of Fife. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
And Bruce Williamson, first of all, on Rail Future and the future of rail, this £500 million that we started off talking about, that won't go far, will it?
No, it won't. But there is a very sort of tortuous series of consultations and processes that you have to go through. They're called GRIP. I think Christian mentioned them, didn't he?
Did, yeah.
And so the where the money will be useful is in funding some of those various stages, getting the initial feasibility studies off the ground, which is a good starting point. But yeah, in terms of actually the cost of opening a line, again, you mentioned, I think, that it's £300 million for the Borders Railway, so £500 million clearly isn't going to go very far.
And there is a capacity crisis in railways in the UK. How does HS2 help that?
Well, one of the most overcrowded lines is the West Coast Main Line. So the general idea is that if you introduce new north-south capacity on HS2, that frees up capacity on the West Coast Main Line, and probably the East Coast Main Line and the Midland Main Line as well, to a lesser extent, so that you can then have more capacity for running slower stopping trains, more freight trains, and so on. Yeah, you're absolutely right, though. The railways are full to bursting point.
So don't we need more actual tracks, you know. So some people have said that instead of HS2, perhaps we should have reopened one of the beaching lines, which I think was the central railway that went up there, and a lot of which is still around, for much less than these more than £100 billion.
They're talking about the Great Central. I think there is a case for extending that, probably not all the way, because the problem with the Great Central, it goes right through the centre of Leicester and right through the centre of Nottingham. So that's, you know, very difficult practically. But, you know, when people say, shouldn't we open other lines instead, I don't think it should be seen as an either-or thing. We need that mainline capacity north-south with HS2, and we need to reopen lines and extend capacity on our existing lines as far as possible.
And what about Scotland in all of this, in terms of reopening or assessing lines for reopening?
Well, Scotland actually has done rather better than England. You know, we've got Airdrie, Bathgate, the Borders Line, Stirling, Alloa, and so on. So actually, Scotland has been a little bit more forward-thinking. And those examples I've quoted and others where lines have been reopened, they have been a huge success. And in most cases, they've far exceeded expectations. Again, Christian said everything I wanted to say really this morning, but you know, he's talking about the you know, the Borders Railway being a huge success, and how corners were cut on specifying it, and now we're paying the price for that. That, you know, we can't run the number and frequency of trains that we want to run.
Well, a question I didn't ask him about the Borders Railway is I wonder whether it will ever be restored to what it was, which is the Waverley Line, which went all the way through Hoyk and down to the border and linked up with the West Coast Line. Do you think that'll ever happen?
I do, actually. I think there's a very strong case for it. I think I'm not going to say when, but I think it's very likely. You're absolutely right. The only slight problem, of course, is that Carlisle is in England, so there has to be some sort of deal done between Scotland and England to fund it, and I don't know how torturous that's going to be, but you know, clearly it's been a success so far, and with that through connectivity rather than it being a dead end line, I think that hugely increases the commercial viability of it.
Well, let me bring in someone who has campaigned for what is actually a dead end line, Eugene Clark of the Leaving Mouth Rail campaign. Congratulations on that, because it was a long running campaign. You've eventually got a decision in principle anyway that this will go ahead. Do you know any more in terms of detail of when that will happen?
Yes, thank you. And it's much more than a decision in principle. We've had the money committed, the £70 million committed by Michael Matheson, the Cabinet Secretary for Transport. And work has already started on the first part of the design, and that's due to be finished in June. And that will be deciding the sort of main features of the design, such as the whether it's single or double track, electrification, where the stations are, and that, so on and so forth.
I thought there were going to be two stations, one at Cameron Brigg and one at Leven.
That's correct. The exact locations are still to be finalised, but we're hoping that the one in Leven will be adjacent to the bus station, thus helping an integrated transport system, and the one at Cameron Brigg will be placed to take advantage of the tremendous amount of new housing that's getting built in that area.
And what are
a very attractive place to come to if you stay in Edinburgh, for
sure.
Example.
What are the arguments then that won this for you? Was it about, say, extending that sort of commuter belt that is already in Fife for going into Edinburgh from places like Dalgety Bay, but now up to Leven Methil, I don't know, Largo or whatever?
Well, yeah, I think there's a number of factors there. The most important one is that the Leaving Mouth community had been largely ignored, certainly in public transport terms, for 50 years since the line closed in 1969. And what this meant was that there was a lot of, if you look at the Scottish Index of Multiple Deprivation, for example, we figured rather highly in that, unfortunately. So the case for reopening the line was economic and social, as well as in purely transport terms. And I think one of the things that made the difference was the fact that the assessment of our case changed, certainly over the 7 years I was involved in it, from looking at it purely as a business case to taking in these wider economic and social factors. And to that, I think the key factor was the support from the community. Local people wanted it, and they didn't give up, and they gave us support, especially at those times when it looked as if it was never happening. So you had the combination of the two things. When we then brought in fantastic support from our local politicians of all parties, I hasten to add, probably the first time all parties have agreed in a particular campaign, but they did so again over the 7 years. And I think these things combined made it successful.
I did mention rather mischievously that it's a dead end, and I suppose it is. You look at the map and there it goes. But it was, of course, a railway that went all the way around the East Nuke of Fife. Now, that would have been a tremendous bonus, wouldn't it, for tourism. Is there any chance that that could be reinstated? You know, something that goes all the way round past Ely and Pittenweem and Crail and yes. All these lovely places.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I've travelled on that, giving you a slight idea of how old I am.
That'd be before 1963 then, or whatever it was.
Indeed, yeah. Yes. I think that's a little bit of an outlier, shall we say. But Leven Mouth is far from a dead end, and when we look at what's happening in the area over the next 4 years, we're having the railway reinstated, we're having a £50 million project from SEPA to create a fantastic reuse of the River Leven and all its facilities around that. We're having an active transport system developed, and we even have a project to build a pier with a large whale on it.
Oh, I saw that, yeah. I think it was two whales crossing over. That looks remarkable.
But that's a rather imaginative representation, yeah. Shall we say.
All right. Bruce Williamson from Real Future, when you listen to that, does that chime with other projects that are being thought of around the place?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think what's important is that you have that that local grassroots campaign to drive these things forward, and the support of local politicians. So it's obviously very heartening that, you know, you get cross-party support for these things. And obviously you need an awful lot of patience. These things take time. It's a frustratingly slow process. You don't get these lines reopened overnight, sadly.
Let's bring in our paper reviewers, Ken Garner and Katie Grant. And I know that both of you use the railways and have interest in them. Katie, what's your feeling about whether we should have more, who pays for them, all that sort of stuff?
Well, I think one of the very interesting things that we haven't heard, we didn't hear anything about climate change, and surely that's going to also drive the railway. I mean, I use the railways a lot, particularly the West Coast Railway. I never fly to London, partly because, you know, I hate flying, so my hatred of flying and climate change have nicely coincided. We need to encourage people onto the railways, and I think climate change would be a good driver of new habits. So we haven't heard much about that. But
no, and I think the electrification, it seems incredible to think, but like what we now have in central Scotland, we didn't have 20 years ago, is four electrified passenger lines between Edinburgh and Glasgow. There's capacity, you know, if one line's closed, trains can be rerouted, and they've been doing all this with the huge work that's been going on the main route. And then there's been all this huge investment in Queen Street, and I know because I use it and my wife uses it a great deal, and it's like it's been awful for people going through Queen Street for a few years. But then, as I often say, that station has been an eyesore since the 70s. It was 40 years overdue, that rebuild, and it is now at least happening, you know.
Bruce, tell us about the Green Agenda and how much that will drive, you think, policy and spending on railway investment.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned electrification, because it's something that we're very keen on for not just for the environmental benefits. Obviously, if you've got an electric railway, you can use wind and solar power to drive your trains, and they're, you know, absolutely pollution free. But whilst the capital costs of investing in electricity are very high, electric trains, once they're installed, are cheaper to run, they're cheaper to buy, they're more reliable, they're faster, they're quieter. You know, it's an absolute win-win-win-win-win. So, interestingly, just yesterday I read that the Indian government are committed to electrifying their entire network within the next 5 years. Yeah. Contrast that to the, you know, spectacularly unambitious plans in this country, and it's really quite shocking.
Yeah, but Bruce, so, if you see rail as a social benefit, then how do you is it accepted as a social benefit here? And in that case, how do you explain this high concentration on spending in Scotland, for example, on the Central Belt, and you try to take a train out of Inverness and, you know, make sure you've got your coat on and don't expect a buffet? I mean, what is the divide there, and what has to be the political reasoning on social benefit in trains?
Well, you know, the social benefit is acknowledged in the fact that our railways are subsidised. You know, if we ignore the social benefit, then going
but
back to...
But my point is, up to a point, they're subsidised, you know, to the social benefit of certain areas, but arguably it doesn't spread to more remote areas.
Yeah, I think you're right. And maybe that's just a simply... a sort of political thing that the politicians don't tend to live out in the sticks? And also, where you've got the highest density of passenger use, you get a better economic case. So when you're looking at your sort of low-hanging fruit of cost-benefit analysis, the best wins are most likely to be in London and in Scotland, in the Central Belt. And then you have to sort of work outwards. I suppose, you know, in some ways it's quite reasonable that, you know, from a politician's point of view, that they get the best value for money for their investment, you know, in the first instance. But you're right, you know, we've got to look at the whole network and not exclude the...
Yeah, so I just wonder if we're opening new stations and new bits of track, should we also consider closing some of the less used stations? I was just looking at Barry Links, which is sort of up near Dundee, and that had, in 1 year, in 2017-18, had 52 passenger uses in a whole year.
Yeah,
that's not really worthwhile, is it?
Well,
it is if you're one of the 52 people.
Well, exactly. That's a good point, actually. And as Christian said, you know, we wouldn't consider for a second closing any loss-making rural roads. And, you know, in the general context of rising passenger numbers across the board, I think we should be looking at a growing railway. And there are also very good examples of where you have slightly sort of desolate, unloved stations, where you get the local community involved to sort of... to adopt them and promote them, then you can have astronomical changes in passenger use.
There's not many people around Forsenard or some of these other North Line stations that Isabel's so keen on.
I know, I'm just arguing.
The five-hour trek to Thurso.
If you're defining social benefit, how do you define that for remote rural areas and population spread?
No, absolutely. I was being mischievous. And
that's one word for it.
Your eyebrows went up slightly at the thought of the subsidy that's going to rail. But there is another argument, which is to say, actually, should we not be subsidising buses? That's what the poorer... sections of society use?
Well, and also, you know, you've got to get home from the railway station. The bus is often the place which gets nearer to your actual house. So I think it has to be an integrated system because people want to get from their house to their destination. Mm. The railway station is just somewhere en route.
But that's also why, as you say, it's better to take the train from Glasgow to London because you cut out all that getting to the airport and the time. And it's actually, I mean, I'm a convert like you. I don't fly anymore. The train, I have to get up early, but it's much better.
Okay, I think that just about does it. Thank you very much. I should actually just ask Eugene if there's what the next step is for Leavenmouth.
Well, the next step is for the rail to be, the line to be constructed, of course. And hopefully what we'll see is the outcome for young people, because that was the most important driving force of our campaign. We have a generation, possibly more than that, of people who don't see a future in Leavenmouth. The impact of the line, with its resulting employment, access to higher education, so on and so forth, will change this. And we can already, it's funny, we can already sense a change in the atmosphere of people in the community. It's fantastic.
Eugene,
and in 4 years' time, it'll be unrecognisable.
Eugene Clark, thanks very much. Thanks also to Bruce Williamson and Ken Garner and Katie Grant. That's it from us this morning. We'll be back next week.